The following talk was given by Mary Sullivan at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on July 29, 2018. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Thank you so much for coming. Let me explain about my voice. For those of you who don't know me, I have an issue with my vocal cord. And when I'm nervous, it gets worse. So sorry about that. If you can't hear me, please let me know. I am perfectly willing to repeat what I said. For those of you who don't know who I am, I'm Mary Sullivan. I've been a student here at Dharma Field since it opened. So I've been here a long time. The inspiration for this talk came out of the blue. In the last 3 or 4 weeks, a line from Trusting the Heart Mind popped into my head. I mean, literally popped into my head. I was not thinking about anything pertaining to the practice. I don't know what I was doing. I wasn't really engaged in much of anything in terms of what I was thinking. So this is a relatively obscure Zen poem. I'm the Doan for meditation on Friday nights, which means I open the place up, I open the windows in the summer, turn on the lights, set things up, light the candle. And I've been doing this for a long time. Paul was the original Friday night Doan, and when he decided not to do it anymore, I took over. But Paul was the inspiration for reciting Trusting the Heart Mind. We recite the Fukan Zazengi by Dogen every Friday night during the last 10 minutes of the second sitting. And Paul really liked Trusting the Heart Mind, so we started alternating recitation of the Fukan Zazengi with recitation of Trusting the Heart Mind. So I've been reciting this for years now. I went back to Texas in late 2007, and then came back in 2011. And then I took over again as Doan, Friday Night Doan, maybe in 2012. So this has been a fantastic opportunity, really, for me to come back to these teachings, Trusting the Heart Mind, Fukan Zazengi, over and over again. The line that suddenly popped into my head was, without a thorough understanding of oneness, both movement and rest will be insufficient. I've talked about parts of Trusting the Heart Mind before, but this kind of intrusion of this line into my thoughts just was so striking. It was like a bell that rang in my head. I really can't explain it. And I have to tell you, I don't claim a thorough understanding of oneness at all. And whatever I say about this, please don't hold on to it. Don't believe anything I say. And don't be misled by the word understanding. It does not refer to being separate from what you or I already know. Oneness is always our experience. If you listen to Norm, if you listen to Steve, they're telling us this. But we ignore that. We ignore our experience in favor of what we think or believe. I have decided to treat this line, without a thorough understanding of oneness, both movement and rest will be insufficient, as a koan. Now, this is a Soto Zen Center. It's not a Rinzai Zen Center. So technically, we don't work with koans here. But we do, in a way, because we keep coming back to the teachings over and over again. So I've come back to this Trusting the Heart Mind over and over again on Friday nights. Steve's taught a class on it. Steve Matushak taught a class recently on the Fukan Zazengi. So there are many opportunities here to work with the teachings as you would work with a koan. First, a little bit about trusting the heart mind, which in Chinese is the Xin Qing Ming. It's a Zen poem. I might argue it's got a lot of Taoist influence because it talks about the way. And it's by Seng San, who is the third Chinese patriarch, Bodhidharma being the first. And when I say Chinese patriarch, what I mean is when Bodhidharma came from India to China to spread Zen, he is considered the first Chinese patriarch for that reason. And is he the 17th Indian patriarch? I can't remember. 28, thank you. Norm knows these things. So, Seng San's Japanese name was Kanchi Sozan. And the So of Sozan forms the first syllable of the name for the Zen school, Soto Zen. I think, is that correct? Yay. Seng San was the Dharma heir of Hui Ke. Hui Ke is legendary for having been Bodhidharma's Dharma heir, and he is also legendary, the story goes, for having severed his arm at the shoulder in order to demonstrate to, this is all legend, in order to demonstrate to Bodhidharma his sincerity in wanting to study with Bodhidharma. So, Seng San is Hui Ke's Dharma heir. If this is confusing, I'm sorry. Let me just say that very little is known about Seng San. He was born around 529 Common Era and died around 606, but all of this is very iffy and loose. Per Wikipedia, most modern scholars dismiss his authorship of the Xin Qing Ming, but we really know very little about him. He is probably the Chinese Zen patriarch about whom we know the least, because there's just not that much written about him. According to Wikipedia, however, Seng San died sitting under a tree before a Dharma assembly in 606. There is a line from In the Fukan Zazengi by Dogen that may be a reference to this. Dogen says in the Fukan Zazengi, "In surveying the past, we find that transcendence of both unenlightenment and enlightenment, and dying while either sitting or standing, have all depended entirely on the strength of Zazen." I'm not going to talk about that line, but he seems to be referencing Seng San's death. The transmission of the lamp, with which I'm not familiar, but I think it's a collection of koans, is that correct? Does anybody know? Yeah, okay. The transmission of the lamp entry on Seng San begins with a koan-like encounter with Hui Ke. Seng San says, "I am riddled with sickness." Now, when I've heard this recounted, sickness is not the word that was chosen, but I couldn't remember what the word was. He says to Hui Ke, "Please absolve me of my defilement." Hui Ke says, "Bring your defilement here, and I will absolve it." And Seng San, after a long pause, says, "When I look for it, I cannot find it." And Hui Ke says, somewhat jokingly, "I have absolved you. You should live by the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha." So, I'm going to come back to this. The first things that occurred to me about this line from Seng San's poem, Trusting the Heart Mind, was what movement and rest may refer to and why they are experienced as insufficient when we do not have a thorough understanding of oneness. A few words about what heart mind means. Norm and Steve have both spoken about it in ways that I have found very helpful. Heart mind just refers to totality, to oneness, truth, suchness, thusness. Words that Norm presents to us over and over again to point to this reality. Heart, mind, nothing is left out. Nothing is excluded from heart, mind. It is all of experience. As the Xin Qing Ming says, the one is none other than the all. The all is none other than the one. If only this is realized, the rest will follow of its own accord. So with respect to movement, what came to mind about what he was saying about movement, it occurred to me that this may refer to our daily activities. We're constantly, our minds are constantly in motion, active, awake, alert. We occupy ourselves in many different ways. We distract ourselves in many different ways. And movement, I may or may not be right about this, seem to refer to how we typically spend our time. I at first thought movement is in contrast to rest, but I've decided that's only partly true. That's only on a relatively speaking. As Seng-san says about mind and thing, the thoroughgoing relativity of these two is originally one emptiness. So since trusting the heart-mind is fundamentally about oneness, to set movement over and against rest is ultimately confusing. Then, for some reason, what came to mind about rest was that it referred to, specifically, meditation. And again, this is just my idiosyncratic reading of it as I sort of pondered this line. So the line says that without a thorough understanding of oneness or no separation, both activity and sitting in meditation will seem insufficient. It says will be insufficient, but really it will seem insufficient. In Zen, now you're all going to kind of roll your eyes at this. In Zen, we often talk about, to our peril perhaps, the uselessness of Zen practice. I've even suggested in a talk that when we speak of Zazen as useless, we could turn it into a fifth vow to practice Zazen, though it is useless. And like the first vow, it's like the first vow in its working with the absolute to save all sentient beings, though they are numberless. The Xin Qing Ming seemed to point to an aspect of this teaching I hadn't thought about, that we want something from Zen practice, and that's fine. We all come to it with ideas about what we want, what we don't want, like enlightenment, for example. And this seems to be because we don't understand the oneness of Zen practice with the rest of our life. We see it as somehow set apart from movement, activity. Just like we tend to dichotomize in our minds, because this is what the mind does. And this is mind with a small m. It dichotomizes movement and rest, being and non-being, gain and loss, right and wrong. We don't see that Zen practice really is our life, and that whatever we do is our life, regardless. However, as we've talked ad nauseum about here in Dharma Field, when we see Zen practice as a means to an end, any end, for example, for lowering blood pressure, being mindful, focusing attention, helping to relax, loosening attachment, reducing suffering, we've lost sight, really, of the true nature of Zen practice, of our own true nature. All of these things are not separate from us. And what the Xin Qing Ming seemed to point to in that line about movement and rest, both movement and rest being insufficient, was the very habit of mind that makes them seem insufficient. That habit of mind which sets things apart from one another, over and against each other. You don't have to take what I'm saying at all at face value. You can see this for yourself. This is available for you to see anytime. You don't have to believe a word I'm saying. So the Xing Xing Ming says in the fifth couplet, so early on in the poem, it's a long poem, it's in the chant book. I think starting on page 16, he says, to set what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. This is a very interesting line. What is he saying? I'm going to just give you my hypothesis. This is something to be returned to over and over again. So Seng San seems to be pointing to a process of constant selection, of putting right here what one wants and way over there what one doesn't want. It's a mind that prefers one thing specifically over another thing, and so has ignored oneness. This is the, quote, disease of the mind. It's a habit of mind. We do it all the time, and we're largely unaware of it, largely unaware of when we do this. We do this without realizing we're doing it. It is how we relate to what shows up, appearances of out there, of other things, people. It's how we relate rather casually and sometimes rather cruelly. As the poem says, by our accepting and rejecting, or picking and choosing, or not seeing all things equally, we lose sight of the true nature of things. You may wonder, who cares? I'll get to that. So the true nature, really, of our life is oneness. And Seng San seems to be saying, notice. Just notice when you are engaged in this habitual accepting and rejecting. That's all he's saying, really. Notice, as Steve says, this is a very interesting expression. I've never heard anybody but Steve use this expression before. Picking and choosing mind. Nothing wrong with this mind. Don't try to reject this mind. Don't reject anything. As it says in the Xing Xing Ming, nothing is excluded. Nothing is left out, including picking and choosing mind. And it's not that, as I'm trying to tell you, it's not that it's bad or wrong. It's just that a mind that leads us around by the nose in this way, which it tends to do because we are unaware of it, it leaves us thinking that reality corresponds to the goodness or rightness of what we have picked and the wrongness of what we have rejected or are offended by. And we think this is a distinction that is worth making in the first place. So we end up being led astray by that mind into thinking that reality corresponds to these ideas about things. The poem goes on to say, when nothing offends, the multitude of things vanish along with the mind. A very interesting, difficult line. It points us to noticing what happens when there's, for lack of a better word, I don't even know what word to use, kind of a dropping away of egocentric preferences. I really like what Norm has to say about attachment and what Steve talks about as non-attachment. There is really nothing we attach to. We can't attach to anything. First of all, there's no I or ego that attaches. And there is nothing. That which we think we're attaching to is empty. And you don't have to take my word for this. You can see this yourself. You can see this in Zen practice. You can see that things are constantly coming and going in awareness, appearances. And just as quickly, they drop away, they disappear, they're gone. If we don't hold on to them, if we don't play with them. So this line is pointing to the nature of oneness. This line, when nothing offends, the multitude of things vanish along with the mind. And it really cannot be explained. I can sit here from now until noon and try to explain this line to you, and I can't really do it. Instead, the poem seems to be saying, just notice this process of mind. Notice the accepting or the rejecting mind. Notice the mind, as we say here at Dharma Field, leaning toward what we want and kind of backing off from and away from what we don't want. And notice that this is totally when we have this experience. Notice that what we're rejecting or accepting seems totally separate from us. Just notice that. That's all it's doing, is drawing our attention to that. Even that doesn't fully say it. I just can't do it. But when there is tranquility of mind, oneness is revealed. Don't take my word for it. Honestly, no matter how hard I try, I just can't say this. But that line points to actually experiencing oneness, of experiencing the dropping away of preferences. It also points to patience with oneself in practice, of gentle, patient practice. The Xin Qing Ming also says in this very second couplet, when you neither love nor hate, it appears clearly without disguise. This is the way, or oneness, or totality. When you neither love nor hate, I did a talk once, and I didn't explain it very well. Is it possible for human beings neither to love nor to hate? At that time, that question intrigued me. Of course, loving and hating, these are two extremes, aren't they? It's another way of talking about accepting and rejecting. But the Xin Jing Ming says it in such a stark way, when you neither love nor hate. I mean, there it is. The way appears clearly without disguise. Oneness appears clearly without disguise. Don't take my word for it. So the poem warns us about a lot of things, about a lot of extremes. It warns us about getting caught up in extremes of ideas, of even relative and absolute. Or, as the poem says, appearance and emptiness. Actually, the Xin Qing Ming is a cautionary poem about getting caught up in any extreme and staying there without realizing we've been caught. It's going to be a short talk. So, about the absolute, about which really we can say nothing, the poem says, do not seek after truth, with a capital T. Only cease to cherish opinions. When I first met Steve, his book, How the World Can Be the Way It Is, was coming out, or had just come out, or was about to come out, or had been accepted for publication. So when it first came out, David and I, either you gave us a copy or we bought a copy, and you inscribed the inside of the book, do not seek after truth. Now, I was just beginning to get into this practice, and I found it totally shocking. What do you mean, don't seek after truth? Come on. Why am I here? What do you think I'm doing? I'm here in your living room studying the teachings. Of course I'm seeking after truth. What a ridiculous thing to say. I was really not offended, but really kind of disconcerted. It's like my feet had been cut out from under me. I mean, think about it. When you come to this practice, don't you want truth with a capital T? Of course you do. We all do. We long for truth. That's another thing Steve said. Maybe one of the reasons why I kept coming back. He said what we really want is the truth. That's really the only thing that satisfies us. We think lots of other things satisfy us. So we're engaged in all this accepting and rejecting in an attempt to satisfy ourselves. But really only one thing satisfies. Satisfies the ache of the heart, as he put it. I don't know if you've ever had any ache of the heart. But that phrase that he used really caught my attention. So, do not seek after truth. Why not? Why not seek after truth with a capital T? Anybody have any thoughts about that?
It's already here.
What?
It's already here.
Yes, that's one thing. Yes.
Seeking truth produces separation.
As the Shin Ching Ming says, we end up denying the nature of truth when we seek after it. Yes, all of that is true. But again, it's very hard to hit the mark with this with words. You just have to kind of let that sink in. Do not seek after truth. The poem suggests what happens when we do that. What does truth then become? Notice that what is bothering Huika when he makes his supplication of Bodhidharma is that he is experiencing his defilements or sickness as somehow separate and apart, as diseased and thus rejected, at least for the time being. But then Bodhidharma says, show me this sickness. Point it out to me. And when Huika really takes a look at that, he can't find it. It's not to say that he hasn't experienced that pain, that sickness, whatever you want to call it, that defilement. But when he really, objectively, is sitting quietly, tranquil mind, not caught up in this and that, he cannot find it. He cannot find it. So Bodhidharma jokes, I freed you. But really, with that question, show me your defilement, show me your sickness. He and Huika work together to help Huika see that it's not separate and apart from him. And in this, Huika experiences oneness. Don't believe me. So, as I said, in helping Huika become aware of what he was doing, of separating, of somehow perceiving or conceiving of some aspect of his experience as a defilement, as sickness, he has shown him his true experience of oneness. We do not live separate or apart from the truth, which is what Mike was saying, what Nancy was saying. And this is always our experience. I don't know why I think the time is going to be emblazoned on your feet. I keep looking at your feet. Anyway, so the next line of the poem says something similarly helpful. It says, do not seek after truth. Now, Steve didn't add this next line, which may have been a good thing, because it left me wondering what really was going on there. Or maybe he thought the next line would be too much. The next line says, only cease to cherish opinions. Only cease to cherish opinions. Now that's in the realm of doability. Don't seek after truth. I don't know about that. I'm going to pursue truth relentlessly. But then the poem says, relax. Relax. Only cease to cherish opinions. It's not that hard. Maybe. What are opinions, anyway? Could you say opinion is another word for preference or dislike? Notice the word cherish. What does that imply? What does the word cherish imply? Do not, he says, only cease to cherish opinions. Often we don't realize how dearly we hold to our opinions. We base our self-worth sometimes on opinions about our performance, our opinions about others. If we're attacked, we might immediately form an opinion of that person's worthiness, credibility, you name it. because we feel attacked. So the Xin Jing Ming is just saying, notice how dearly we hold to certain ideas about things, about our likes, our dislikes. Just notice that. That's in the realm of doability. Maybe not seeking after truth, but this is doable. The poem also gives us another hint about what cherish means in the next line. It says, do not remain in the relative view of things. Avoid such pursuits carefully. It doesn't mean, it's not saying, okay, the relative view, we work with that all the time. This is consciousness. Consciousness enables us to function, enables us to act. But it's saying, don't remain there. Notice when we're stuck there. Do not remain. Remain is the key word there in the relative view of things. Then he says, if there is the slightest trace of this and that, the mind, small m, is lost in confusion. Again, it's like, you can see this. Uchiyama Roshi has a great drawing in his book. What is his book? Approach to Zen, but there's the new one has another title.
Opening
the Hand of Thought. So he has this great drawing about the Z line, Zazen, and then their trajectories falling off the Z line and then coming back to the Z line. He talks about, so that's Zazen, this line. It's a fine line. It's an interesting drawing. What this poem is talking about is how this slightest trace of this and that, and there's confusion. And that can be seen. This is another thing that can be seen. Sitting in Zazen, whenever I prepare a talk and I have to give a talk, and then the day of the talk, I'm sitting in Zazen, all I can think about is the talk. Well, that's not true. I can let it go. I've gotten better at that. But that's been a hard thing to do. I'm so preoccupied with what I'm going to say that it's difficult to let go of that preoccupation and just sit quietly before the talk. But this, we know what that's like, those of us. I mean, you all have sat Zazen, you know what that's like. You know how easily it is to be swayed by these opinions, either for or against, that show up. They show up all the time. That's fine. So, after that, he says, the two exist because of the one, but do not hold on to the one. Now, I'm not going to explain this well. It can't be explained in any way, shape, or form. The two exist because of the one. One is capital, the O, and one is capitalized. And he seems to be pointing to the functioning of consciousness. So, within wholeness and totality, lots of things are showing up. There are myriads and myriads of appearances. This is the functioning of consciousness. As Steve said, this is what allows us to go to the store and pick out tomatoes that are rotten and bring them home and make a salad with them or tomato sauce or whatever. So consciousness, which divides reality up, is very useful, very helpful. If we're not reliant on a GPS, it enables us to get from one place to another. We know to go east so many miles and south so many miles, and things are all neatly divided up and gridded out and very, very useful. Some of us still don't use a GPS to get around. So again, we're not talking about anything separate from wholeness or totality. And consciousness gives rise to appearances. Things are constantly showing up. So Sengsan is not in any way denying the experience of this and that. He's just saying, don't do the same thing with oneness. Don't hold on to it. Don't cherish any ideas about oneness. Don't have a preference for anything you might think about what oneness is. And again, I want to emphasize, even if we have some idea about oneness, we can't really hold on to it. If you notice, the ideas morph all the time. We have, one day we may think we have a good idea about something, and the next day, in the light of something else, in the context of something else, it's a lousy idea. So it's the same thing with any idea that we have. And then the question then becomes, is there any stability? Is there any peace in this life? And the Xin Jing Ming is pointing to that, pointing to what that peace and stability are. Steve talks about this all the time in his book, Meditation, Now or Never. Norm did a talk on that book a couple of weeks ago on lines and passages from that. So, to return to my koan, without a thorough understanding of oneness, both movement and rest will be insufficient. What prompted this talk was the dissatisfaction that I've experienced recently. So this koan, as I said, suggests that dissatisfaction arises from not seeing oneness, from getting caught in ideas and beliefs about how things should be and how they simultaneously should not be in some other way. I've been experiencing a lot of dissatisfaction with a whole variety of things that I've seen as set apart from what I imagine as more desirable. I've been impatient with my experience of constant fatigue. I've chided myself for a whole variety of things in connection with that, like if I exercised more, I'd have more energy. I've chided myself about failing to get up for a few morning sittings a week. Although I have not given up on the idea of getting up at least one morning a week for the second sitting or getting some regular exercise in the interim. But in the interim, failing to do either one, I've decided just to be more patient, to let go of expectations. They do die hard. But there's always just coming back. For example, because of all the pain in my left knee before surgery, and then because after the surgery, I had a big leg length discrepancy. The new knee made my left leg longer than my right leg. And that, it's interesting, objective fact, if you want to call it objective, is experienced subjectively all the time. When I'm tired, the one leg, the right leg, seems a lot shorter than the left leg. When I'm not so tired, I don't feel the discrepancy so much. But anyway, I'd stopped leading walking meditation on Friday nights. So for those of you who've come to any sitting here at Dharma Field, there's the first sitting, then there's walking meditation, and then there's the second sitting. So I've been letting my husband, David, I've been asking him to do the walking meditation for me. I had no idea how I was going to manage walking meditation with this imbalance. I have felt off balance. But David went on Friday to see his mom in Texas. So I was hoping James Parker was going to show up for meditation. James Parker is a longtime practitioner here at Dharma Field. He's been a Doan. He's been an Eno. He knows how to do walking meditation. James didn't show up. So that meant I was going to have to lead walking meditation myself. And also, David's been coming to help me do things like move the cushion around, put the chair there, open the windows, adjust the shades, that kind of thing. And I've been taking that over more and more as my knee has gotten better and better after the surgery. But Friday was all up to me, and I did manage it. And So for the first time in about 5 or 6 months, I led walking meditation. It was not so bad. I did it. I was glad that I had given myself the time by asking David to take over, and also glad that ultimately I had taken it over again. Walking meditation, no big deal. or big deal but manageable. Again, that's probably going to vary. So, to end, which I probably should, I want to turn to the Fukanza Zengi. Again, this is in talking about my dissatisfaction. Dogen says in the Fukanza Zengi, and this is a line that we don't often talk about much here at Dharma Field. He says, although it is said that there are as many minds as there are people, still all negotiate the way Solians us in. These lines just, you know, they sort of trip off my tongue. I've been saying them for so many years. I've been reciting these poems for so many years. And in discussions about tranquility of mind, calming of mind, clarity of mind, and the lessening of the grip of disturbances of mind, I have felt at times that my experiences have differed. Although I have certainly experienced lessening of the grip of disturbances of mind, calming of mind, tranquility of mind, I've also been caught up in the grip of traces of this and that, disturbances of mind, even frank, gross, and grossly distorted delusions with some predictability. So when Dogen says that there are as many minds as there are people, I felt reassured. Now, mind you, he's not saying for every person there's a distinct mind. When we talk about small mind in this way, we're not talking about the minds of individuals. Really, there is no such thing. But he's talking about the variability of experience, what's showing up. And this is not a characteristic of your mind or my mind. There is no such thing. But he is talking about this experience. And he says, even though I wasn't looking for reassurance, this reassurance just sort of showed up, as did the line from Trusting the Heart Mind, sort of like Letters from Emptiness. There's a chapter in Not Always So by Suzuki Roshi called Letters from Emptiness. So these have been sort of letters from emptiness for me. And then he says, although it is said that there are as many minds as there are people, still all negotiate the way Solian Zazen. I found that incredibly reassuring. It doesn't matter what shows up. Just practice. Just sit in Zazen. All negotiate the way. All. And remember, in the Fukan Zazen, he's not talking to monks. A lot of Dogen's talks have been addressed to his monks. He's talking to everyone here, regardless. That's why it's called universal recommendation for Zazen. That's what Fukanza Zengi means. And as Steve says in Meditation Now or Never on page 63, our only way out is to take in our problems and be nourished by them. Says a couple other things in between, and then he says, ultimately, in seeing clearly the working of our minds, in seeing clearly the working of our minds and the ephemeral nature, read emptiness, of our ostensible problems, we'll find a profound freedom that will never depart. Don't hold on to that. Well, that's it. Any questions or comments? Well, thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.